good afternoon, and thank you for tuning in to Faith and Reason here on Holy Family Radio. Today we're going to be spending some time with Rebecca Teddy, talking about a wide range of topics involving Catholics and their engagement with the broader culture. Specifically, we're going to be talking about women's issues, but also about dealing with life in the modern world, a modern world that seems to be inhumane in a lot of ways, that is very distant institutions closing in on us, making decisions for us. There's a certain kind of coercion that exists in modernity, and how we might not only get around that. There's a lot of people searching for solutions out there, but certainly we think the Catholic tradition, the Catholic tradition's greatest gift to the world is its moral and intellectual traditions, and so we'd like to bring that to bear on some of these issues. Rebecca Teddy is a writer for Catholic Vote and for Catholic Digest, and you can read her also at the Catholic News Agency. And welcome to the program, Rebecca.
Thank you very much, John.
Well, why don't we start off with something many women struggle with? I know we have a 13-month-old baby at home, and my wife and I have talked about this as well. And that is a woman's role in today's society. A lot of families find it, or think it at least, is necessary that both parents work to achieve a suitable income for whatever their needs happen to be. But we also know the great benefits to everyone involved for stay-at-home moms. And so could you speak a little bit towards women's place in today's society?
Sure. I mean, you highlighted the problem right there, that there's a tension that exists for most women. I was going to say most Catholic women, but I would say most Christian women and most women who just want to have children and want to do right by their children. There's an incredible tension that exists between wanting to do right by your children, and most people feel in today's economy also a need to earn some money in order to make a family happen. So there's a kind of constant sense of pressure in a certain way. You know, I'm not doing enough for my child, but I'm not doing enough for my family. And there's a couple of different ways to go with that. I mean, obviously, one response is simply to say, my husband and I are going to live sort of an evangelical witness of poverty, and we're going to, you know, go it alone with one salary, and the mom will be at home completely. And then there are people who sacrifice having family in order to work full time, or and put their career ahead of family life. And I think most of us today probably find ourselves somewhere in the middle, and also to that extent also feeling a lot of pressure one way or the other, because we feel sometimes because of college debts or all kinds of reasons that we just cannot make it without some extra salary. And yet we try to be at home as much as possible, and we want to be there on the sidelines for kids' games, and we want to homeschool our kids sometimes. So there are all kinds of, there's a real pressure that women feel that I'm not certain they've ever felt as much in any other time in history, or certainly in the American experience.
Why do you think that pressure is now? Is it the economy since the 1950s? It seems to, because of inflation, seems to require a great deal more money to live a middle class life. Is it simply cultural? Why now?
That's probably too big a question for me, or it probably exceeds my expertise to give a definitive answer. But I think both things are true. I think there is it's become objectively harder. The middle class in particular has less purchasing power than it once did. And so there are objectively more financial pressures. But then there's also, I think, some pressures that women put on themselves in that, I think the culture has become very bossy, you know, that it tells people, everyone has a theory about what women should do, and you're not doing it right unless you know, there are people who will tell you, you know, that if you're not working outside the home, that you've, for example, wasted your education and you're wasting your life and you could be doing so much more. And for young women today, especially those who've suddenly begun to take their faith seriously, sometimes they're hearing that from their own moms. you know, and so exactly the place where you would normally look for help in raising a family, you're sometimes getting, you know, instead questioning and suspicion. So that's one thing. But I think also the lived Catholic life sometimes comes with pressures that are not really, maybe lived Catholic life isn't what I want to say, but the Catholic culture in some areas, and what I mean by that is not culture with a capital C in terms of church tradition, but just the cliques and groups that exist in parishes or in different communities, sometimes put a lot of pressure on women to live what I call the one holy Catholic and apostolic lifestyle, so that you, which doesn't actually exist. But if you're a new mom and you're trying to do things right, you know, every single book and every single expert and every single woman you look up to has, you know, a whole series of theories about the way you ought to discipline and how much work you can do outside the home and what's acceptable. And that's, you know, that's tough. And it's tough particularly on a generation of young women who don't necessarily come from homes where they had models of what family life looked like.
Is the pressure to homeschool part of that?
It can be. I mean, not always, you know, but I just think that it's rare, or I wouldn't put it this way. I wouldn't say that this is absolutely or universally true, but many women, especially women who are beginning to raise families, do find that there's very rarely a moment where they can just relax and be accepted for who they are. There's always somebody telling them, if you're homeschooling, you should, you know, you're missing the boat, you're going to be raising deranged children and you're wasting your own education. And at the same time, if you're not homeschooling, there are plenty of people who will tell you that, you know, you're destroying your children's souls by exposing them to the evils of the world. And so it's just tougher to make your own decisions. And I think there's a lot of pressure on women to simply conform to whatever model they happen to be exposed to, rather than to, with their husbands, discern what they ought to be doing before God.
It is interesting these days how many people have to turn to books and other people's models, because there isn't that type of culture, Catholic or not, of extended families. I mean, a lot of people move away from their families, or you're right, they're not learning these things from their mother or grandmother or aunts or uncles, and that's a different type of tradition that's being lost, and so then you have to make it up with all these experts. And for the Catholic, what's a good way to separate out that noise? I mean, I know we've got a whole show to do on this, but to kind of go down that path, how do you separate the good from the bad? What works for you, and how do you, Rebecca, avoid being just? I mean, you're not calling yourself an expert, but you're certainly going to give us some advice today. Where can you point us?
Well, I think one thing is to just call this phenomenon out and acknowledge it for what it is. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, I wrote a chapter for a book that Hallie Lord published. It was a compilation of 10 essays from women about work, about contemporary Catholic issues for contemporary Catholic women. And I did one on work. And there I quote something, an idea that has kind of haunted me ever since I first read it. And it comes from a French historian named Régine Pernod, who wrote, she's written many things, but this particular quotation comes in an epilogue to her work, Women in the Days of the Cathedrals. And one of the things she says is, copying is a good school exercise, but it's never produced a masterpiece. And then she asks, why can women of today not invent solutions that are adapted for our own time, just as other women have done in their time? And I think that goes back to your original question, like, how are we supposed to face this question of women's work? And I would have just become, over time, suspicious of easy answers to that question. That I don't think it's the call of Catholics to decide what they are impatient with in the culture and completely break that culture down and rework it and then begin to live their family lives once they've created the perfect Catholic culture.
Okay.
That rather we have to accept the culture that we actually live in and find our way forward living holy lives within, you know, within the means that we actually have. So for some families, the right answer to that question turns out to be, we're just going to live, you know, in relative poverty, and we're not going to have the same material goods that other people have, so that, you know, we can be, so we make a sacrifice in order to, for there to be a stay-at-home mom, and for the, and we live on the husband's salary. But that's not the only answer, and there are some people who will find, maybe because of college loan debts or other kinds of circumstances, that that's just really not a possibility for them. And rather than saying to that person who, you know, who doesn't find it possible, you're doing it wrong, you have to say, okay, how do you make the most, how do you make the best of, you know, of the two-salaried life? And are there ways you can find to live that in a Christian way and still put your, and still, you know, dedicate time to your marriage and to your family? And I think people do find creative ways to do that, whether it's part-time work or telecommuting, or I have three friends who share this one nursing position, you know, which that's a creative, that's a very creative position, and it's kind of win-win for everybody because it allows three nurses who are basically at home raising their kids to keep their skills up to date for some future time when they might need to work. And the hospital gets some really dedicated nurses, and the patients get really dedicated people who, you know, have some energy. And they're able to, you know, make a little money, but also be at home with their kids. And those kinds of real-world solutions, I think, are probably a better answer. I mean, you can talk about things in the abstract, but real life doesn't wait for the perfect situation to arise. We have to learn how to live holy lives in the actual circumstances that confront us. And I think that's part of being open to life, too.
I think that's very good advice. And what I hear you saying is that this question is one of those questions of prudence over which good Catholics can disagree. We would apply church teaching in some way, which says to raise up our children in the faith, etc. But there's different ways to do that. I'm wondering if that would include stay-at-home husbands and working moms. Is that a possibility you see as viable?
I'm not prepared to say no to anything in this culture, right?
Sure.
But, I mean, you might be in a better position than I am, because I can't speak for men, right? I think my own husband would probably shrivel under that scenario, but that's, I do know if I can think of two cases where that is the situation. It's not a perfect scenario, and I think, you know, there's some emotional and psychological needs that for each person that needs to be, you have to meet creatively in that scenario.
Right.
But I'm not prepared to say no. And I think that's fundamentally my point, is that all of us have to learn how to meet the needs of our own families and not think less in the abstract about what would the ideal family look like, and realize, I have to be married to, you know, this spouse, and we're raising these kids, and we're living in this particular city, and, you know, and we have the only these resources available to us. And so, as you say, there's going to be a lot of variations of what a holy family life looks like.
Yeah, I can speak as a college professor. I have a pretty good schedule. And that, you know, we're busy a lot of times when we're not in the classroom writing books and preparing classes and speaking, doing various things, well, hosting a radio program among them. But on the other hand, I do get to be with our child quite a bit, particularly in the summers, and I quite enjoy it. I always wonder whether there's a particular Christian anthropology, and I think that there is. It would, you know, point towards that being more of a woman's calling than the man's calling, but I didn't know if there was anything quite definitive out there. I'm kind of interested in that topic, whether these things are more cultural or whether they're related to us as beings created by God, and this is women are hardwired in a particular ways for particular things, and so are men.
Well, I mean, I think there's maybe a tension in those two ideas, right? There's such a thing as creative tension, so we don't have to absolutely resolve them and close off every possibility. You know, that there are, as you say, there are jobs that have more flexibility in them, and so simply allow for more sort of, I hope people don't cringe when they hear this, but allow for a more sort of nurturing male role at home. And the other thing is that, and this is very clear in church teaching, John Paul II says it, and Benedict XVI, as Cardinal Ratzinger said it too, in various ways using different language, but that the church has no objection, you know, in the abstract to a woman working outside the home, but we do have to understand something about Catholic anthropology and understand a woman is ordered, even if she biologically never has children, she's never able to bear children, maybe because she never marries or because she experiences infertility or whatever, whatever the reason might be. There's something called the feminine genius, which means there's a kind of sensitivity to the value of the human person that's just written into the nature of woman. And therefore, any kind of work a woman does is going to be ordered towards her family and in a way that I think men's work isn't necessarily. And so the question is not, you know, can a woman never, ever, ever work outside the home, but rather what does work look like? What does the schedule look like? You know, what kinds of things satisfy her natural need to give the gift of herself when she works, right? And is it possible that the same parameters of a hard-charging job for a man, that doesn't work the same way, that doesn't look the same for women, or for most women? There are probably some women who do get a foil in the same way that men do from a hard-charging job. But for most women, what they're doing is a little different, that they have to put their own, they have to put their own families and their own self at the center of the work that they're doing in order for them to find it satisfying. So in other words, what I'm saying is the church doesn't really have a formula that I see. What it has is the constant refrain that you have to put the flourishing of the individual human person at the heart of the decisions that you make.
So would you say then, so John Paul II has probably played a very important role in forming your understanding about motherhood and womanhood? Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, in 1988, when he published his encyclical on the role of women, Mulieris Dignitatem, I was unmarried at the time, and the first time I read it, I thought, honestly, it seems boilerplate to me. Like, there's no new teaching here. I didn't understand what everybody was talking about. But I was asked to lead a little study group on it, and so then I had to find something to say. So I started praying, using it to pray, and a whole world opened up to me when I prayed over that document. And it really, I would say, revolutionized some of my own thinking about what I personally was called to do and what I personally was capable of. And I think that's really an extraordinarily beautiful document that has a lot to say to us still.
Are you familiar at all with the work of Sister Prudence Allen?
I am, yeah.
Philosopher. We had her at Aquinas here a while back at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids. She was our St. Thomas Aquinas Week speaker, which is one of the big lectures of the year during St. Thomas Aquinas Week when we celebrate our patron. And she gave, it was a history of, I guess, what you had called the feminine genius from classical Greece. And she tried to bring it on up through the present and pretty much made it, but she just went through all these philosophers and different views on women. It was fascinating, but it really seemed like there was a culmination somehow with the thought of John Paul II. But I know that in our culture, many people would reject John Paul's teaching on women, not because he was a Catholic or a pope or a saint, but because he was male. And I see this in as a history professor. I see this a lot of times, the thinking that a non-African American can't teach African American history, or a male can't teach women's history. That somehow these things are not possible. I gather you would probably disagree with that.
I do. I mean, I actually find that position sort of tedious, to be honest with you. But moreover, I find it a little bit scary because actually I think that the idea is beginning to take hold. And I mean, to leap wildly from what you're talking about to just the question of, you know, civics and politics. You know, Abraham Lincoln once said, and this is the thesis of his Crisis of the House Divided speech, but he said, you know, drawing from Christ in Scripture, said a house divided against itself can't stand. And he used it to talk about, you know, the Civil War and slavery, but basically that at any given time, a society is animated, obviously by lots of different opinions, but one single thought animates a society. And that thought, he argued, is either going to be all men are created equal, or it's going to be might makes right, because those are the only two choices.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that no polity is ever going to perfectly embody the principle of all men are created equal, but at least if that's the dominant civic idea in people's minds, then you're at least working towards, you know, the dream of the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. And if you throw that idea over, the idea that all men are created equal, then all the different, you know, iterations of alternatives that you might come up with just come down to might makes right. And so that's at the political level. I would say at the much more deep spiritual level that John Paul II was working at, you know, he, I think, began to address something that Benedict XVI also has addressed and that Pope Francis has now picked up in both Lumen Fidei and in the Joy of the Gospel, which is this idea that we're somehow, modernity is turning away from this idea of a common fatherhood and therefore a common brotherhood and all men are created equal. And what we're looking for is to put the human person at the center of our civic life and of our economics and of our decisions. And instead, you know, it's kind of the sense of equality is broken down, and when, you know, we're choosing winners and losers and asserting our own rights over other people. So anyway, the entire education process, to the extent that it teaches us to think only about the ways in which we differ from each other and never about what we hold in common as human beings, I think it's dangerous.
Where do the debates over the definition of marriage fit in to this? By this, I mean the cultural pressures either to tell women to work outside the home or not to work outside the home, or that would even tell them that, you know, by staying at home, you're not really contributing much of anything.
Yeah, that's a couple of different questions.
Yeah.
Let me just address, because I just like to say it out loud, the thing about the idea that if you're not working outside the home, you're not contributing anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those of us who are Catholic know that that's preposterous, right? There's nothing. We understand that the greatest gift that we give another human person is really the gift of ourselves at some level, whether that's as husband and wife in marriage, or whether that's parents giving themselves to their children. And in fact, this is what we're made for. You know, the woman has a particular innate sensitivity to the value of the human person, but we're all called to live by, John Paul II called it the sincere gift of self, and Benedict XVI called it the law of gratuity. But that we don't find ourselves and we don't flourish as human beings until we're, in a sense, giving ourselves away to others and receiving what they have to give. So, you know, a culture that insists on assessing people only by the pragmatic and by the material, you know, what are you contributing, is deadening everybody and making everybody miserable. But then also, my friend John Mueller wrote a book a couple of years ago called Redeeming Economics, in which he tries to restore the economic understanding of self-gift to the field of economics. And he does this really remarkable calculation, just a material calculation, right? That, in other words, the most important thing is that we give and receive love in order to create a great, a just society and in order for the human person to flourish. But even at just a purely material level, John does this calculation and concludes that two-thirds of wealth creation is actually caused by what economists call human capital, which means, in other words, not machines and the kinds of things that we invest in for businesses, but rather actual human beings. So the minds and the muscles and the creativity and the work and the invention of actual human beings. And so since there is currently in our economy no incentive for the investment in human capital at all, you know, we don't provide tax breaks for having more kids, you know, or for educating a young person, you know, in the same way that we do for businesses that want to, I don't know, buy a Mac or buy an extruder machine. And so that means that every adult that a stay-at-home mom sends out into the world is an incredible, enormous gift of wealth that she's given to the country just free of charge, right? Here's 20, 25 years of work to make a flourishing human being that I gave to you, my nation, right? And that's two-thirds of the wealth of the nation comes from that. So, I mean, there's all kinds of directions you can go in conversation from there, but one is just the enormous gratitude we have to have for, you know, for moms, you know, who make the country, you know, and, but it also shows just the ridiculousness of the direction the country is going at the moment, where our whole new healthcare system, for example, is predicated on the premise that a human person is a cost. You know, and in other words, we want to limit the number of human persons that there are so that we give free contraceptions, contraception, for example, and free sterilizations because people are a burden to society. But that's, you know, not only offensive from the Catholic point of view, you know, and offensive to the understanding of what a human person is, but it's extremely stupid, economically speaking, because it means you're killing the source of two-thirds of wealth.
I think that's something the Chinese discovered with their one-child policy.
Exactly.
After many, many years, that they have an overabundance of men, not enough women, and what do you do with a population like that? And unfortunately, historically, usually it's war. That's what cultures, civilizations traditionally have done when they have an overabundance of men or, you know, a population-type problem like that. If the human person is ordered to know, love, and serve God, then I know what you're getting at here is a real economic argument for stay-at-home moms that could be used to convince people in our culture, because those are the types of arguments that they find convincing. That is, if they see everything as a cost, and I guess to engage the culture in some ways, we have to speak their language and use what convinces them. But I wonder about the danger in giving a defense like that. That is, that it might imply that somehow we're all here to serve the economy or the state or to generate wealth, maybe to generate tax revenue. Do you see any? Am I wrong to think that? I guess I'm a little bit afraid of that.
No, you're not. I agree with you that if that is the only thing we have to say, that's a pretty limp. It's a pretty limp defense, to be honest with you. It's not going to motivate most people. But I think it is valuable in the following way, and it is that the woman who is a stay-at-home mom, or, you know, or working, you know, part-time outside the home, but basically stay-at-home, who gets sneered at parties. So, you know, I live in Washington, and sometimes you can go to a cocktail party, and as soon as you say you're a housewife, well, first of all, nobody would ever say that. I'll tell you a funny story. I was at a party, and I actually, you know, I'm somebody who's always had some kind of part-time work, but I just had a bee in my bonnet about this disrespect for moms. So I was at this party, and somebody said, "What do you do?" And I said, "I'm a housewife." And the gentleman with whom I was speaking took it very well, because sometimes at these sort of Washington cocktail parties, you can get somebody who kind of immediately looks over your shoulder to find out who he can network with who will do him some good. This gentleman did not respond that way, but out of the corner of my eye, I saw this woman stare at me in horror. And I'm not usually somebody who is a shrinking violet or shrivels under that kind of thing, but she just kept looking at me the whole evening in such a way that I felt very uncomfortable and like, I want to go hide in the corner. And at a certain point in the evening, she, you know, pigeonholed me, so I had to talk to her. And she said, "Do you know what? I'm a housewife too, but I've never had the guts to admit it in these circles." So she was amazed that somebody would admit it, right? So in other words, what I'm saying is that for people who are feeling pressured, like the appeal to an economic argument is not, it's a limp argument for the culture at large. But for women who are feeling, or who are maybe hearing from their parents or from somebody that what you're doing is not worth it and you're wasting yourself, it's important to remember, on the contrary, this whole ball of wax collapses without you and your kind. And you're doing something very important, mm-hmm. you know, even at the level that other people are working. And, of course, you know, in a much deeper level, because you're, you know, forming a soul that is bound for eternity.
That's a very, very good point, good way of looking at that. I've heard that that fear, especially from women with college degrees who've gone to college, including all the way up to the doctoral level, and then for one reason or another, they are a housewife. Sometimes working a little part time, sometimes not, but in general, a housewife, and they hear that all the time. Because mm-hmm. they've invested a substantial amount of money and time in an education that allegedly they're not using. What would you give them a pep talk, Rebecca? what would you tell them?
I think one thing to keep in mind is that women really are different, and there's not, in other words, I'll describe two situations. When I was single, well, and even after I was married, but my husband and I had a period of infertility where it was not obvious for the first 4 years of our marriage that we would ever be able to have kids. So I was working as a pro-life lobbyist. And that is the kind of work that is very, very rewarding. And in other words, it's a gift if you can do something that you love or something that you really believe in, as opposed to just having a job that pays the bills but that you're not particularly excited about. And so, you know, sometimes we have these rarefied discussions about work and careers, and, you know, the vast majority of us never have the fortune of doing what we really love. We're just husbands and wives, right? Men also, you know, end up in jobs that are a little bit repetitive and don't necessarily, you know, you have to dig a little deep, you know, to say, oh, I find meaning in it. Like, the meaning is I'm bringing home a paycheck that's supporting my family and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I was doing something that I loved, absolutely loved, and found meaning in and was grateful for, just I personally experienced a kind of depression from just having a sense of this is not what I was born for. I'm meant to have children, you know, and I'm dying to be at home and to get up every morning and put on my power suit and my stockings and do something, you know, that I was actually, you know, good at and had value that I could believe in, became just difficult for me. So then when finally, thanks be to the Lord, and we were able to conceive, I was so happy to leave the career world behind. It was just like an emotional relief. And I think many women feel that, they're just a delight to be home, you know, and mm-hmm. to make a nice household. And I've always had the freedom, because I'm blessed, to, you know, dabble in some things that interest me without having to do full-time work. And that's the way I thought about it. And that's the way I do think about it, not having to.
Right.
But I know, I have friends who really and truly, you know, they had wonderful careers, and those careers meant a lot to them. And for them to be at home, they objectively, they don't feel the way I did, you know. They really do feel, they miss it. They, you know, it's not that they dislike their children or, you know, but they're just made of different stuff for all kinds of reasons, and not all of them have to do with dysfunction in, you know, we just have different temperaments and different things we're drawn to and different things that the Lord lays on our hearts. So one thing I think is important when we talk about these things is not to make the blanket assumption that every woman is the same and thinks about things the same or has the same emotional reactions to questions of duty and questions of, you know, homemaking and child rearing and work outside the home. And I think sometimes Catholics have a way of talking that assumes my situation, assumes you want to be home and that you don't miss anything about work and that there's something wrong with you if you do. Whereas I think we have to be very sensitive to people who loved what they were doing and have really made a, for them at least, heroic sacrifice to be home, or to, you know, or to, you know, be working only part-time in order to raise children. And the raising of children doesn't come as naturally. So I think the first part of the pep talk is to just let's accept women as they are and not talk them out of the actual feelings that they have, but then, you know, motivate, you know, keep putting in front of, you know, in front of everyone the truth of the matter, that the way the culture talks about things is not the truth of the matter. And there's a lot, there's a wide field of creativity and delight in the education of children. And then, you know, for, you know, in certain families, if you have the capacity to help your children flourish and then also do some work outside the home, there's nothing wrong with that.
It seems to me what we're talking about then is there's two avenues here. There's the non-Catholics that we as Catholics want to communicate to, using our tradition and everything in the moral and intellectual tradition of the church, that we want to communicate something very valuable about motherhood and fatherhood and the value of every human life and what the human person is created to do. And we want to communicate that to them the best we can in a culture that is busy redefining everything from marriage even to the human person, you know, who's human and who isn't. Just speaking of abortion, but, you know, also in my mind are past Supreme Court cases, even like the Dred Scott case. But then there's talking to our fellow Catholics, right, which is what you and I have been talking about the last few minutes. That is a communicating to our fellow Catholics that there's not just one answer to some of these things. I really think you have injected a great deal of common sense into the discussion about everybody's situation being different from everybody else's. And that means maybe answers are going to be different. We should not just assume things when we go talking to other Catholics. I think those are very good points you made. I appreciate that. Let's talk about the communication with the non-Catholics here, or at least with society at large, if we can, and move away from talking specifically about women and just we as Catholics then, male or female, looking at a culture and a political culture, I would say, but also a culture that's in some ways very disengaged from politics, that does not put the human person at the center, in the way that if we were to draw on St. Augustine here, would say that, look, yeah, the city of man does have a purpose. It's not that it shouldn't exist, but it's simply to keep the peace so that the city of God can flourish and we can come to know God, right, and come to know our final purpose in God. What would you say on that tack? That is, how can we as Catholics do a better job at telling the world and giving the world the blessings of our teachings on marriage and manhood and womanhood? Because no matter how good we're doing, it seems like things are only getting worse. So either it's an uphill battle, it's an insurmountable obstacle. I'm not sure. To say it would be insurmountable would be to despair, and we don't want to do that.
Yeah.
But maybe, I mean, I'm sure there's things we're doing wrong, so I guess this is the kind of question where I'm saying, tell us what we're doing wrong, tell us what we're doing right. What do you think?
Well, you know what, you hit the exact note that I want to hit by bringing up St. Augustine and his distinction between the city of man and the city of God. And I think there's kind of three things. But the first thing is simply that when, I'm not speaking about people who are themselves politicians or some of our finer, more philosophical essayists on the question of politics and its interaction with faith. But I'm just talking about popular Catholic culture, sort of our most popular sort of bloggers or the kinds of conversations you get involved in, you know, at coffee and donuts after Mass in a parish. I think there's a lot of expecting politics, imminentizing the eschaton, if you want to put it that way. Expecting politics to bear a weight that it actually cannot bear. That is, the city of man has to exist, but it's kind of, it's not here to create the perfect society. It's created to, it exists really to have a kind of peace and a kind of bare minimum justice in which human beings have the freedom to flourish and to pursue the higher goods and, you know, it's hopefully to make it to heaven. But when we start to look for, you know, ideal economic systems, or we expect every, you know, certain economic systems to make people holy, we're looking to, you know, nobody would put it that way. Nobody would say that's what they were doing or acknowledge that's what they're doing. But the kind of, this is maybe a broader example of the subset that I was talking about earlier, which is my little pet peeve is I think a lot of Catholic culture right now is, in a funny way, kind of anti-incarnational. And what I mean by that is we sort of refuse to accept the limits of a human being. We want people to be angels. So we want our politicians to be angels, and rather than making clear-headed assessments that, you know, this person is not, I don't know, it is not evil incarnate who has betrayed the faith and the Pope and everything that is holy. What this person is a person who's motivated by honor, and so he's very, very good on certain kinds of questions, and he hasn't really thought his way through any of the other questions, right? So then it gives you an idea of what you can work with and what you can't work with. And I find that we're actually, even our own people, Catholic, good Catholic politicians who are serious about life and are serious about defending marriage, easily get thrown over as traitors for the slightest little deviations of policy because we're looking for our people to be, you know, saints and angels rather than assessing them as human beings. So I think that's one kind of problem. And, you know, just understanding that people have, I'll give you an example to maybe make that more concrete. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we have St. John Paul the Great, and there, even among Catholics, he has a lot of critics, right? And, you know, and people are mad at him because they feel maybe he didn't do enough about the abuse crisis, although he did do quite a bit, which is not all that publicized, you know, or he certain kinds of questions didn't get fixed in his pontificate. But, I mean, my goodness, you know, he brought down communism, and he freed millions of human beings, and he gave us the catechism, and he renewed the faith of millions, and, you know, the list of his accomplishments.
It goes on and on, sure.
Goes on and on, right? And so the idea is to be angry with him for what he didn't do, for the fact that things that he started didn't get finished. I mean, he's just one man. I mean, even if he's the Pope and a very holy person, right? And so enfleshment means, and incarnation means, that we're finite. And so each of us has a mission, but if we are lucky, we have a big impact on one or two areas in life, and we can't do every mission. So the idea of evaluating our Catholic leaders and our politicians on the fact that they aren't, you know, that they haven't done everything is kind of ridiculous, right? And I think a lot of us judge our own lives that way, too. In this kind of, we're trying to live as angels, and we forget that if I choose to homeschool, that brings many good gifts with it, but it also closes off some possibilities. And so I can't engage, I won't be able to engage with the culture of a school, you know, in the same way from the outside as just a parishioner supporting that school as I would if my kids were students in it. And that's, you know, okay, and different people be called to different things, and the Lord lays different things on our hearts. We kind of have to learn to be faithful to our own missions and not try to live every mission simultaneously and therefore not ever do anything really, not ever really choose. And we have to be careful not to ask politics to do what politics can't do and to be satisfied with doing some simple practical things to keep the culture wholesome rather than trying to make everybody into, a personal devotee of St. John Paul II.
Well, I think when you talk about trying to get politics to accomplish things it's not meant to accomplish, I think that, well, at least for me, for a very long time, that seemed to be the case. And one day I realized, which is the emphasis of this program, that culture is so much more important. and that culture, like civilization, this is the painstaking work of generations, and I think you're absolutely right. You, as Russell Kirk once said, brighten the corner of the world in which you live, and this is what you're able to do. And it's only the very modern progressivist mentality that wants to fix, so to speak, everything right now. And somehow we're doing a terrible job if we haven't done that.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that I've never really thought of that on a personal level before, as far as, my own life or the lives of individuals. I always think of it in the big picture of the nation. But what I hear you saying, I thought using John Paul II was great, really good example of that. When you start tabulating what he did do and to dwell on the fact that I guess I would describe it as, administrative skills were not his strongest point. We've all known bishops. I usually divide bishops into the administrator category versus the pastor category, and rarely do the two meet. Sometimes they do, but they come with different gifts, and hopefully with the timing of the Holy Spirit for whatever your diocese needs. But rarely do you see the two combined.
Now, I also think that there's a way in which, I mean, you can never live in a culture without being affected by it in some way. And, you can be a pious, and I mean that not in the sarcastic sense, but in the best sense, you can be a pious and very faithful Catholic. And so you won't be touched by, maybe the culture, even resist the culture's attitude towards life. But it's hard to resist the progressive attitude that we're all kind of know-it-alls, and we can tell others, and we can fix things for everybody. And I think there's a lot of, I don't want to insult anybody because everybody's so well-intentioned, but there's a lot of kind of inhumane talk among just Catholics about, about other people, because we just think, again, we can kind of impose the one holy Catholic and apostolic lifestyle on people.
Mainly in the blogosphere, isn't it? This is where we can really let loose and forget ourselves.
And in some kind of Catholic, there are certain kinds of Catholic cliques that are quick to roll their eyes and make judgments about people. And the worst criticism, the enemies of a man shall be those of his own household. And sometimes the worst, like the people who undermine fellow Catholics the most are very often fellow Catholics who are just quick to say, well, you're not doing it right. Well, I wouldn't do that apostolate that way. But Simca Fisher has a great line, I think, for her mom, which is, I like the way he does it better than the way you don't. sometimes you have to, it takes a little bit of a thick skin sometimes, not only against the culture, but against possible critics, amongst your own colleagues and friends and Catholic community who mean well and certainly don't mean you any harm. But we're all just quick to be sure we know how other people should live. And that's not, within the bounds of Catholic morality, that's really not true.
No, and it reminds me of, oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's all.
It reminds me of a little of families. And, the closer you are to somebody, the more critical you can be, or the harder the fight is, like a civil war. And when it comes to strangers, maybe you're less hard on them than the people who are 99.9% just like you, sitting next to you in the pew, right?
Well, it's funny. I mean, that you say that, John, because just recently I was talking to somebody and I said, when I was an atheist seeking and thinking my way into the church, people in the church were much more gentle with me than I feel they are now. Or if you raise a certain question or you've asked a question and you immediately get, there's a lot of sort of proof texting of encyclicals in the same way that the evangelical church in which I left used to inappropriately proof text the scripture, and part of that is exactly right. Part of that is a good thing. It means I'm part of a family now, and once you're part of the family, then your in-laws let their hair down. And
that's a good way to look at it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's a good thing, but on the other hand, sometimes we're just not, we ourselves, if we wonder why we don't attract people, sometimes it's because we don't realize what a narrow, what narrow conversations we're having and how off-putting and distressing that is to people. Somebody I was sitting, actually at the National Catholic Prayer Breakfast, I was sitting with someone who works for the, actually for the USCCB. I probably shouldn't say what his actual title is since I didn't ask permission to share this answer.
Okay.
But he speaks around the country, you know, 3 or 4 times a year, or a month rather. And he was saying that Catholics over 35 are not really very open-minded in his experience. They tend to, all they want to know is what box to put you in. Like, you know, are you a First Things Catholic or are you a National Catholic Reporter Catholic? Mm-hmm. You know, are you pro-life or are you social justice? And that's all they want to know is what box you're in, and then they're done with you. Whereas he said younger Catholics, they're not even aware of any of those debates. They can't follow them. They don't know what they're about because it's outside their experience. And what they know is they love Jesus, and they love babies, and they love the poor. And the good thing about that is that they're sort of tabula rasa for further formation, because if you ask them, he said, if you ask them, what do you think about this? Have you ever considered this? They'll say, no, tell me more about it, rather than putting them, you know, rather than just putting you in a box. They want to learn. And then the negative thing is that their faith is basically, it's highly sentimental, and so they do have to be somehow led to firmer ground on which to base their ideas.
I think that was part of the genius of St. John Paul II's World Youth Days, in embarking on reaching the youth. What you've described is the students that I have at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids. That is... when I talk, especially people over 60, and they will still be talking about everything from priestesses to celibacy, just kind of the usual topics that we've heard ad nauseum for several decades now. And I tell them, you know, the students just really don't care. In fact, they don't even debate things like should churches have kneelers. They just kneel whether they're there or not. This is just what they do. And you're absolutely right that they don't divide. Especially, I see them not dividing along the lines of social justice on one side, and then somehow orthodoxy on the other. That you can kind of be the person who goes around working for Habitat Humanity, or you can be the person who shows up to adoration a lot. But you can't really be both. And they just will never see it that way. And they tend not to use categories like conservative and liberal either when they're talking about religion. Maybe if they're astute enough, they might use those when they talk about politics, but certainly not about religion and belief in the faith. Those terms, they just somehow intuit that they don't apply.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, I felt like a closing thought, and it has fled my mind.
Okay. Well, it's true that we're in the closing minutes of the program here. I know you have a hard break and somewhere to get to, Rebecca, and I thank you for being on Faith and Reason today. Just to remind our listeners, you've been listening to Faith and Reason on Holy Family Radio, Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo, and we've been speaking with Rebecca Teddy for approximately the last 45, 50 minutes or so, and you can read Rebecca Teddy's work at Catholic Vote and at Catholic Digest. And if that thought hasn't occurred to you, I have a question about a piece you wrote recently in our last close. We have about 2 or 3 minutes left. A rather provocative essay you wrote on clericalism for CatholicVote.org. I think it was recent. I read it recently, but it seemed like it was only a month or two old.
Yeah, that's right.
And what intrigued me was you drew this distinction between lay involvement in parish life and living the kind of Catholic life that can transform the culture, that can sanctify the culture, like we've been talking about this past hour. So I was hoping in the closing minutes here you could say, well, what kind of clericalism do you mean? Because it was a different kind of clericalism than what I would think of it as, and as well as your talk of lay involvement. That lay involvement, that a lot of what we call lay involvement, actually, in an odd way, is clericalism. So you were advocating something a bit different.
Yeah, something that Benedict XVI said, and it's not unique to him, but just his quotation that stuck out to me, was something he said in various forms to bishops whenever he traveled, was I happen to have the quotation right in front of me, so I'm going to read it. This is something he said on a pilgrimage to Fatima. He said, "The courageous and integral appeal to principles is essential and indispensable. Yet simply proclaiming the message does not penetrate to the depths of people's hearts. It does not touch their freedom. It does not change their lives. What attracts is, above all, the encounter with believing persons who, through their faith, draw others to the grace of Christ by bearing witness to him." And so this is something that Benedict was, you know, talked about all the time, that you have to have clear teaching. It's fundamental, but it doesn't touch people's hearts. What they have to do is be introduced to Jesus. And so my thought in the discussion of clericalism was just that, to the extent that the church is worried about the internal workings of the church, and obviously that's necessary. I'm not denigrating that. I've served on my parish council over the years, and I work on various different parish apostolates and projects, so I find that work meaningful and important and something I feel called to do. So I mustn't be misunderstood to mean, hey, if you're just a lector, you know, or if you're just serving on your parish council, you're not doing anything. But the point is only that, to the extent that we as the church are thinking only about the church and what's good for it, we are missing the boat of what evangelization is, that it's not only about the internal workings of the church, but it's also about introducing people to the faith. And the normal way that happens is, there's something different about this guy at work. He's joyful and I am not, you know, or he's honest and he never backbites. And that challenges me, right? And I think, actually, this is what I started to say earlier and I lost my thought, was that when we are evangelizing, or when we are engaging culture, there's sometimes an attitude that we have like an unspoken attitude that people who are outside the faith or who just don't get what we get as Catholics, we're sort of angry as if they ought to know those things and they're rejecting them. And I think that's just not the case. I think most people don't really know very much about the faith. They have no idea what the grandeur of the faith and the joy is, and what people who have lost, in a culture that's losing its faith or has lost its faith or has forgotten the meaning of its faith, they have the right to look at people who profess to be practicing Catholics and say, you go first. You know, in other words, people are looking to find their hope in us. So you want me to live marriage a certain way, or you want me to value chastity a certain way? Let me see it, right? You live your life that way, and then I'll begin to believe that maybe true love is possible. But don't give me abstract lectures and then not show me anything different in the workplace and in the community and, you know, at the carnival down the street. And that's the kind of thing I was getting at.
Okay.
To the extent we can't keep thinking about the lay vocation as simply, you know, how much help can we do for father, or how much help can we do at our parish, and not, I have to live as a disciple out in the world so that people see what it is to be in love with Jesus by the way I live. That's the more important mission of lay people, because clergy and religious can't as easily do that.
Well, thank you. And I want to thank you, Rebecca Teddy, for being on the Faith and Reason program today. I really appreciate it. I've enjoyed the past hour immensely.
Me too, John. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And thank you all for tuning in to Faith and Reason here on Holy Family Radio. Please continue to tune into our show. We have an encore on Saturdays and, of course, every Friday at 2 p.m. This is Dr. John Panero wishing you a good afternoon.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Panero, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Panero is Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.